Yes, a warm welcome, especially if it's your first Sangha night, or if you've not been to Sangha night for a while and it's your first one back, especially warm welcome to you. So I'm giving a talk this evening called A Solid Foundation, and it's the third in our new series of talks about mind training. So mind training, the alchemy of the emotions. Yeah. And this is the mind training tradition. It was looking at the seven-point mind training tradition. This has come down to us from Tibet. It was put together between about the 10th and the 12th century. And it's very interesting because it's not concerned with the theoretical understanding of things, of the Dharma. It's very, very concerned about how to apply the Dharma. That's what it's very concerned with. Not just when we're in lovely, special, supportive conditions like being at the Buddhist Centre or being on retreat or being with our spiritual friends, but in every situation, in every moment of every day, how can we apply the Dharma? So when we're out with our friends, when we're with our colleagues at work, when we're at home with our family, all possible situations for practice. And the subtitle that we've given this theme, The Alchemy of the Emotions, alchemy is a process, a magical process, where we take base metals and they're transformed into precious gold. And this image brings us into the realm of magic and mystery. And personally, this really appeals to me. So most of you who've ever heard me speak before will know that I really like Harry Potter and all things wizardy and magical. So this really appeals to me, talking about magic in terms of the Dharma, because I think that something incredible and mysterious and magical does happen with the Dharma, is very true of the Dharma. Both in terms of the profound truth that the Dharma describes, which is beyond words and concepts, but also in terms of the magic of the transformation which practicing the Dharma can occasion in people. And when I look at myself and compare how I am now to how I was 13 years ago before I'd come here, like in some ways I'm the same, but in some ways I don't recognise myself. I'm completely transformed. And I see that going on for people around me, transforming very, very radically. And that is the power of the Dharma. It's wonderful and awe-inspiring. So I think magic is a very, very good way to talk about and think about the Dharma life. And mind training is a tradition which shows us how we can more and more intensively weave that magic in the midst of our everyday lives, more and more consistently, using the crucible of our intense day-to-day situations to fire that magic of transformation within ourselves. So that's what we're doing, we're exploring in this series. And one of the very helpful things about the mind training tradition is that it has these little pithy slogans. So little bite-sized chunks of Dharma, which are quite knotty, that you can carry around with you, a little bit like words of a song or poetry, that can penetrate your everyday. So when you're just getting on with something, the words pop into your mind and they help you to re-engage with what you're doing differently. And in the course of this series, we're going to be looking at quite a lot of different slogans. And at the end of each talk, you get a little card to take away with a slogan, which is very, very sweet. So thank you to Aridasa for that. So if you come to all the talks, you can collect the whole set. So that's what you should do. So do ask your group leaders for a card. And tonight I'm going to look at the very first one of these seven slogans, which hopefully, there we are. First, train in the preliminaries. So it's not totally crystal clear what that means, is it? It's not totally obvious. So you do find this with the slogans. They do need a little bit of unpacking. So that's what I'm going to be doing in this talk, is unpacking what this means. So let's just look at this word preliminary. So what does preliminary, let me say it, what does that mean? And the dictionary I looked at says, coming before an important action or event, especially introducing or preparing for it. So the first reminder is pointing us to the groundwork that we need to do in our practice if we're going to make any big shifts in the way that we behave in the course of our everyday lives. And these bigger shifts will be pointed to in the slogans that we'll do sort of later on in the series. So we need to do the groundwork, because although the Dharma is magic, it's not random. So everything, one of the Buddha's very important and basic, one of the first teaching really, the first thing he recognised after his enlightenment was that all things are dependent upon conditions, and the magic of transformation is no different to that. So any magical transformation that we manage to do will be based on our attending to these conditions and looking at the preliminaries, so preparing the ground. So there's not, in the actual text, it doesn't say what the preliminaries are, but there's a lot of commentary about this. And most of the people in the commentaries agree that what we need to look at when we think about the preliminaries is, as you might have guessed, a list. And this list is the four reminders, sometimes called the, and this will be on your card, sometimes they're called the four reflections that turn the mind, but I quite like reminders, I think that's quite good. So the four reminders, this precious human life, impermanence and death, the suffering of samsara, and the law of karma. So it's not a terribly complicated intellectual list. So there are a few terms in there that I'll unpack and go over. But when you're looking at that, you're probably not there thinking, that's completely a new teaching for me. I had no idea about death and impermanence. I've never heard of karma before, so this is not something any of you hopefully will be thinking. So it's quite self-explanatory in a certain way, but it's quite strong, isn't it? So asking us to think about death and suffering and so on. So my question, I suppose, to start with is, why would we bother beginning by looking at this list? So this is the first thing we're going to do. Why is this the first thing that we're going to do? So in order to do anything, we need to be motivated to do it. For example, I am currently training for a piano exam. Now, I really love playing the piano, but training for an exam is not exactly the same as playing the piano. It's not always loads of fun. So I'm trying to master lots of difficult scales. I'm trying to master lots of complicated sight reading with like five flats in the key signature. I'm trying to get to grips with little bars where I'm constantly falling over my own fingers. So it's very, very hard work, actually. It's not all fun, it's quite difficult. So in order to stay engaged with that process, I need to be very clear about why I'm doing that and keep that in mind. So I have to bear in mind how doing these exercises and learning these things, these boring things, will improve my playing, which in turn will give me a lot of joy. And the more, and I know that the more able and skilled I feel, the more joy I feel in playing the piano. I have to bear in mind how much I want to pass the exam, how much confidence that will give me, how it will help me to go on to do more and more complicated pieces that I really love, and so on. And I have to bear in mind also that I really don't want to fail the exam. Like, I really don't want to fail it, mainly because it's so expensive, actually, to take. But I really don't want to fail the exam, so I have to bear that in mind. Because if I don't, then I can get very lazy, actually, and I can go for days without practicing, and that's not a way to pass the exam. So need to bear those things in mind. And my piano playing is not different. Everything else is like that. Everything is like that, including the Dharma life. Sometimes in the Dharma life, we're very inspired, aren't we? We're kind of really up for it. We feel really fired up. And that's lovely when it's like that. But we're unlikely to feel inspired the whole time. Sadly, if you're new, that's just how it is, I'm sorry. Sadly, we're not always inspired all the time, especially, actually, when we're in these difficult day-to-day situations which the mind training is asking us to practice in. We're not always going to feel like, yes, a really difficult work colleague, brilliant. We're not always going to feel like that. So we need to be kind of in touch with our motivation. So this list of four reminders isn't telling us anything we don't already know, but it's reminding us of simple truths about things we already do know, which hopefully, when we're connected with them, will inspire us to practice and to fire us up. So I want to look at these four reminders in turn and to think a little bit about why we bother to reflect on these things, how they might motivate us to practice. So the first one, this precious human life, this precious human life. So why is the human life precious? Why is it precious? Well, apparently, it's very unlikely that we would be born to being a human, first of all. So there's a lovely traditional image about this from the Buddhist tradition. So it goes that there's the mass, you know, there's all the oceans of the earth, and at the bottom of these oceans, there lives a blind tortoise. Sometimes it's a turtle, sometimes it's a tortoise, depending on which book you read. But anyway, I'm going to say tortoise, blind tortoise, at the bottom of the ocean. And every 100 years, it comes up to the top of the ocean to take a breath. And on the top of this ocean, randomly, is floating a yolk, which just imagine a wooden circle, a little wooden circle. And apparently, being born as a human is as likely as that tortoise accidentally poking its head through the yolk. as displayed in this picture. Not very likely. Yeah, I know. That is actually a turtle. Sorry. Anyway, I don't think it matters too much. I think the point is it's very unlikely. So, and then you think, well, is it really that unlikely? It's a lovely story, but there are 7.7 billion people on this planet. So is it, and it's not that unlikely that we'd be born a human. But when you consider the possibility of being born a human versus the possibility of being born another living organism type creature, it really puts it into perspective. So I found this fabulous graph here. That little tiny square of blocks, of red blocks on the top, is the humans. This is in gigatons, in the weight. So apparently, weight-wise, we have more chance of being born as a mollusk. So humans account for an absolutely titchy-witchy part of the animal kingdom. So when you look at it like that, actually, it's quite unlikely that we would be born in the human body at all. So that's quite precious, I suppose. But the mind training actually is going a bit further than that. It's not saying, oh, well, it's great that we're born in a human body, the end of the story. Actually, it's using precious human life in a particular way. It's talking about a human life, a life where it's possible for us to have the conditions to meet, be receptive to, and practice the Dharma, and to move towards attaining transcendental states. So that's what it's meaning when it's saying this precious human life. So achieving the human form would be just the first step in that. And of course, you'll be unsurprised to discover there are lists about the sorts of things that need to be included to achieve this sort of human life, for these things that need to be going on for us to happen. And they're called the freedoms and endowments. So things we need to be free from and things that we need to be endowed with or given. So I'm going to show you these. So sorry about all this listage, but don't worry too much about it. I'm just going to show it to you so we can go through. I won't sort of dwell too long on it, but I think it's quite interesting to see the list. So these are the 8 freedoms. So the first freedom, the first of the 5 freedoms, 1 to 5, is the freedom from being born in one of the non-human states. Okay, one of the non-human states. And these are the non-human realms of the Wheel of Life. So if you're new and you haven't come across the Wheel of Life, don't worry too much. You'll all have seen it. We waved it about on week 2 of the intro course. Here's a picture of it, so you might jog some memories. But I don't have time to go into that in depth now. But just suffice it to say that we can think of this as not being trapped in a mental state which is so intensely suffering or neurotic, it prevents us from engaging properly with the Dharma. So we're free from being trapped in intense states of neurotic craving, like the hungry ghosts, free from being trapped in intense states of mental anguish, like the hell beings, free from being trapped in intense states of aggression and powerless, like the Titans. Free from being trapped in, well, really very lovely, blissful states that never change, which lull us into a false sense of security, like the gods. Have I missed one? Yeah, and free from being like an animal. So free from being driven by our basic drives. So those are all mental states where we've kind of become overwhelmed by unskillfulness. It's very difficult to practice the Dharma when we're very solidly trapped in one of those states. When we can be free from one of those states, that's when we move into the human realm, which is the 6th of the 6 realms. And in the human realm, there is bits of suffering, but there's also some pleasure and ease and more perspective, so we can see that suffering in, you know, it's only part of the picture. And from that more truly that human realm, it's more possible to practice the Dharma. So we probably all know for ourselves what it's like to be trapped in those really kind of horrible states where we're kind of really trapped in our own mind and we can't really see a way out. And then we know what it's like to move into a state where actually it is more possible, it becomes more possible, we get a bit more perspective. This one is reminding us that when we do have those moments of perspective, when we do reach that more human state, then to make the most of that, because that might not last very long. So really seize that human moment. So the second one is the 6th, freedom from holding wrong views. Is it interesting? Because we all hold wrong views, don't we? So we've all got quite a strange idea about things, I think. Otherwise, we wouldn't suffer if we all completely had right view. But I take this to mean we don't hold such strong views that they impede our ability to be receptive to the Dharma and to practice the Dharma. And I was thinking about one such view might be a very strong belief in a creator God, an eternal creator God. So if somebody held this view very, very strongly, that there was a creator God, and was unwilling to let go of it, it wouldn't be possible for that person to practice the Dharma in its fullness. Although they might benefit from practicing the precepts and so on, they wouldn't be able to go the whole way and practice the Dharma fully. So that's something else we need to be free from. We also need to be free from the absence of a Buddha, which is interesting, isn't it? We can't, there haven't always been Buddhas. Apparently, according to Buddhist cosmology, it's infinite. So those world systems have been coming in and out of being for an infinite amount of time. And not all of those world systems have had Buddhas, actually. So we're very lucky that we've got a Buddha. We're very lucky that Siddhartha Gautama went forth and discovered the path to enlightenment. He may not have. So we're very lucky about that. And finally, freedom from significant physical or mental disability. So, just want to clarify, this tradition isn't saying that anyone with a significant mental or physical disability is not properly human, is subhuman. That's definitely not what it's saying. Remember that we're using human in a particular way, which is somebody who's capable of hearing and practicing the Dharma to attain enlightenment. And I was thinking about this myself recently in terms of my own health, because as some of you know, I have ME at the moment, and recently it's been a bit of a drag. I've been particularly tired, and it's been especially difficult for me to meditate and to practice the ethics, because I've been very, very tired. And I noticed just how difficult it was for me to meditate in those states, and what a very strong impact it had on my practice. And I suppose at those times, I wasn't free from significant or physical or mental disability. So this happens to all of us, and it's going to get in the way of our ability to practice. And it's going to get worse as we get older, sadly. It's not going to get any better. Our bodies won't work so well. It's just the way it goes, isn't it? So these are the things that we need to be free from. So if these we need to be free from, what do we need to have? So what do we need to have? We need to have these 10 things. So the first 5, a Buddha has appeared in the world, a Buddha has taught the Dharma has continued, followers of the Dharma have continued, and we have the love and support of others. So basically Sangha. So we've got the Sangha. We've got a community. We've got this community that we're all sitting in. We've got the community of Tri Ratna across the world. We've got the community of Buddhists who've existed since the time of the Buddha. All those Buddhists have practiced and passed down what they've known. And without those, we wouldn't be here. So we're very, very lucky to have that. Very lucky. And so I personally have a lot of gratitude to all those people who've, over the years, kept going so that we could have the benefits of what they've practiced. And particularly, I'm grateful personally to Bhante Sangharakshita, who set up this movement, and we're all benefiting from his efforts that he made. So the first 5 basically can be covered by the Sangha. And then what else do we need? So we've covered being born in the human form. Born in a central country, that's quite interesting. So traditionally, this would have meant that we're not in one of the outlying countries. So these are Tibetan teachings. So we wouldn't have been right on the fringes in the kind of wild lands, the bad lands. So one of the things that would have meant for them if they lived far away is they wouldn't have had easy access to the teachings. And Buddhist history is replete with examples of really amazing teachers going off on these really kind of death-defying journeys across seas and mountains to retrieve the teachings from other countries and bring them back to their own country. And it makes very exciting history, but I must say I'm quite glad that I don't have to do that every time I want to look up a bit of Dharma. So I was trying to research for this talk, and I Googled 7-point mind training and found a commentary by Gampopa in like 2 seconds for free on a PDF. And I'd much prefer that to the whole kind of going across the icy mountain and Himalayas. So we're very lucky. We've got unprecedented access to the Dharma like never before. It might not always be like that, actually, you know, sort of post-apocalyptic vision of the world. We might not always have the web, but at the moment we do. So that's really great. We're also very fortunate to be English speaking, actually, because I know lots of people who, for whom English isn't their first language, they live in other countries, and the Dharma isn't so freely accessible to them, so it's often translated far more frequently into English than other languages. Another thing about being in a central country rather than a border country is border countries would have been very susceptible to border wars. So we're very lucky that we live in a relatively stable and free society just now, one that we can learn and practice the Dharma quite freely. And it's not like that for everybody in the world by any means. And actually, it might not be like that for us forever. You know, we take that for granted, but we shouldn't, because anything can happen. There are lots of worrying trends of repressive governments popping up all over the place, and I know people who find it very, you know, they're defying the government and the law in order to practice Buddhism in their country. Also, I was reading a story of, it's very sad to read the stories of refugees, and reading a story of a Syrian refugee who had a really normal life, you know, their parents owned a shop, and it was just like dead normal. And then the next minute there was civil war, and now they're homeless, living abroad, you know, separated from their family. And that could be us. You know, we're not so special, that couldn't be us. So yeah, so we're very, very lucky to have that, you know, to be in that position. So number 8 is the use of our senses. We've sort of covered that. Devotion to the teachings. So actually, it's quite remarkable. We've not only come across the Dharma, we've responded to the Dharma. That isn't true for a lot of people. There's something about our personality and our conditioning that's made it possible for us to respond to the Dharma and bring it into our lives. So we shouldn't take that for granted, actually. That's quite rare. That's quite rare. So, and the final one, not reverting to evil deeds. So I suppose I take this to mean, well, even if we've got all of the other stuff, if we don't make most of it by being skillful, we're not gonna get anywhere. We still need to be bearing in mind our ethical practice, even given all of these things. So I hope that sort of slightly makes some sense to you, enough to then to think, well, why? What's the point of going through this list, actually? Because I didn't really want to start by giving you a massive list, but there is a point to it, I think, which is to emphasise, well, how lucky we are. We were very, very lucky in this, you know, here. The fact that we're sitting here now means we're very, very lucky, extremely lucky to have this opportunity. And I suppose the question is, well, can we make the most of this opportunity? Can we make the most of these gifts we've been given? I think I suffer from a little fantasy that at some point in the future, it's going to be easy, or at least easier, to practice the Dharma. I'll be older and wiser, and for some reason it'll just be much easier than it is now. Like, there's this sort of mythical future where the Dharma's dead easy. Don't know, some people are nodding. Maybe I'm not the only person who shares that view. So if I believe that, then I'm just putting off what needs doing now for a later time. But it's not like that. It's not going to get easier. In fact, it will probably get harder. So we're very lucky. So let's make the most of the opportunity that we've got now, because it could easily be harder. So I think that's why that's a good reminder. So it reminds us and motivates us to practice now. So that's the precious human life. So the others are a little bit shorter. So impermanence and death is the second one. So this very much follows on from the first, and in fact, both of the first two and the second two reminders can be seen in pairs. So yeah, probably our health will start to fail sooner or later. But one thing we know for sure, is that at some point, we're gonna die. We're definitely gonna die. It's the only thing we do know, actually, for sure. And we know that this is gonna happen at some point. And that's very important, at some point, because actually, we don't know when. The time of death is uncertain. So I imagine it's not news to any of us that we're going to die. I think we probably all clock this. But I don't know about you, but when I think about my death, it's definitely later on. It's much further into the future. And somehow I'm ready for it. I've done everything I need to do, and I've tied everything up, and I'm sort of at peace with the fact I'm going to die. And it's like it's almost happening to somebody else, actually. It's not happening to me. But the reality is that it's not like that. I could die at any moment. I could die before I finish this talk. I could die when I go home and never wake up again. There's absolutely no guarantee that I'm going to live another day. And I'll let you into a little secret, actually. And one of the reasons that I'm quite diligent about making my bed and tidying my room before I leave the house is because I worry that if I die in the day, somebody's going to have to go and go through my stuff, and there's going to be dirty pants all over the place. So. But I mean, you know, that's quite wise, I suppose, because it's true. Like, I might get knocked over by a bus, and then people, my community, will have to go through all my dirty pants. So. And I listened to a talk by, yeah, both of them there, all there. So I'm doing you a favour, guys. And I listened to a talk by an order member called Vajradarshini on this topic, which is a really excellent talk if you want to go into it in any more depth. And she talks this very stirringly. She says, we always imagine a later. We always imagine a later. We always imagine we're going to have time to finish everything off. But she says, most of us don't get this opportunity. Most of us die, she says, midlife. Such a strong phrase. Most of us will just die midlife. Not in the middle of our life, but in the middle of our life. Just doing what we're doing. We make plans, but we forget they're always provisional. Everything we plan is provisional. And in this connection, I was thinking of an episode. Well, I was about 15 years ago, I was with Naomi in Morocco. And we were travelling around, and we'd meet all these random people, and we'd agree to meet up with them. And we'd be making plans, maybe for the next day. We'll meet at 10 o'clock, and they'd say, yes, okay, I'll see you in the morning. Inshallah, which means God willing. Inshallah. I was like, used to drive me absolutely nutty. I was like, are you going to meet us or not? What's God got to do with it? Either you're coming or you're not coming. Just, I thought it was a very good excuse to be very flaky and unreliable, which perhaps in some cases it was, I don't know. But actually, on reflection, I think those people who say that have got a much better understanding of reality. There's something behind that which shows that they have a better understanding of reality than me. Because I'm there thinking, we'll definitely meet, and they're realising that actually anything could happen. And we might not meet, because all our plans are provisional. So why is it useful to reflect on our death? Why is that useful? Is it not just really depressing? Well, I don't think it is. I think it can be if you get anxious about it. This is something I sometimes fall into. But reflected on correctly, it doesn't need to make for anxiety. Rather, it makes for urgency. When we become aware of the fragility of our human life, aware that every moment could be our last moment, well, it really changes how we think. And some of us might have had moments where we've been close to death, or, you know, where we've been closer up, nearer up to that truth, and it really changes how you see things. It can mean that we really realise we've got to make the most of the time that we've got. We see what's important, and what's unimportant drops away, and we're not interested in it. We kind of focuses us. Vajradarshini has this great phrase that it liberates us from unfocused practice. It liberates us from sort of wafting about in our lives, and then getting to the end of them and realising we haven't done anything. And this can happen in response to both a recognition of our own impermanence and also those of others. And recently, our teacher, Sangharakshita, he died. And I noticed in myself and in other people, actually, that one of the main effects of this seemed to be, it was like a spurring on, like seeing, oh, what's important in this life is practicing the Dharma. That's what's important. And it was like a shot in the arm, rather than a really depressing thing. It brought us more in touch with what was very important. And this recognition of the kind of fragility of life can have all sorts of other positive manifestations. And I was thinking of one of the verses in the Dhammapada, which is one of the kind of most well-known of the classic Buddhist texts. And it says, others do not realise we are all headed for death. Those who do realise it will compose their quarrels. So others do not realise we are all headed for death. Those who do realise it will compose their quarrels. So when we recognise that each moment might be the last moment that we're going to see that person, we're much more likely to try and be in harmony with them, and like insignificant irritations will drop away because we know that that might be the last time we ever see them. And a friend of mine died very suddenly a few years ago now, and I'd had it in mind that we were going to meet. We hadn't met for a long time, and I'd seen him at Butterfield, and I said, oh, right, let's make an arrangement to meet up. And we hadn't got around to it, and time had passed, and then suddenly he was dead. He wasn't there anymore. And if I had really understood this truth, if I'd really taken on that time is short, and there's not always going to be a later, I wouldn't have left it. I would have seen him. I would have said goodbye to him. And I would have said goodbye. You know, I don't remember the last time I said goodbye to him. And what you know, maybe I just said, see ya. You know, so I'm not saying we should all go around like, oh, I'm Sue. You know, like, no, I never see you. But, you know, it's worth bearing in mind, you know. Each time, you know, we might never see each other again. So, you know, let that affect how we behave. So, the third truth, the suffering of samsara. So, suffering, death and suffering. So why would we reflect on suffering? So let's start with samsara. So what is samsara? So traditionally, samsara refers to the cycle of rebirths over many, many lifetimes going round and round and round, which is a traditional Buddhist view, is the view of rebirth. But we don't have to limit samsara to the idea of rebirth over many lives. Actually, it can refer, and perhaps more usefully for us, it can refer to the cycle of us going round and round and round unhelpful and unskillful mental patterns, states, habits, going round and round in circles. And samsara, we could say, is what Sangharakshita would call the reactive mind. So it's the mind where we automatically react to stimuli the way we always have. So something unpleasant arises, we push it away. Something pleasant arises, we move towards it and grasp at it. There's a very kind of automatic reactive mind response. So in other words, samsara is what happens when we're not in the gap. And it's important to understand that samsara isn't a literal place where we live, like, oh, this is samsara here. And what we're trying to do is escape samsara and go over here to nirvana, which is nicer. That's not what we're doing. That's definitely not what we're doing. Anyone who's been around Buddhism for any time has probably heard samsara and nirvana used in these glib ways, and it's very unhelpful because that's not what we're doing. So nirvana, of course, is another word for enlightenment, and it's the opposite of samsara, and it literally means blowing out or extinguishing. But we're not blowing out and extinguishing the place itself. We're blowing out and extinguishing the mental poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, which drive the circle of the reactive mind going round and round and round. And it's that quality of mind, fueled by greed, hatred, and delusion, which causes us to experience the world in the way that we experience it. And in this way, it can be a lot more helpful to think of samsara and nirvana as verbs rather than nouns. So thinking of them as things we do, rather than of things somewhere that we are, a place. So we can think that we are samsarizing when we're trapped in this reactive mind, not in the gap, driven by the poisons, going round and round the wheel. And that's us samsarizing the world. And of course, the opposite, which would be the better option, would be to nirvanize. So to move away from that cycle, to work in the gap, and to do something different that alleviates our suffering. So their activities, their attitudes, their ways of behaving. And so when we're samsarizing, going round that wheel, that's where suffering comes from. So it's a samsarizing activity in our minds that creates the suffering. And this isn't to say that there isn't inevitable suffering in the world. And I'm not going to go on about all the different sorts of suffering, because Bodhinaga did that 2 weeks ago. So if you want to hear a list of all the different sorts of suffering in my experience, I'd recommend you go and listen to his talk, which is from 2 weeks ago, and also Pradaya touched on this last week as well. So I'm not going to go into all the sorts of suffering that there are. But let's just say, suffice it to say, that suffering is inevitable for a human with a human body. Dukkha is the word that's translated as suffering, or unsatisfactoriness, or disappointment. There's also a good translation of it. It's the first noble truth that of conditioned human existence, and we can't really get away from it, not this side of enlightenment anyway. And even the Buddha, with his, you know, being all enlightened, he still experienced the suffering of an aging and sick body. So even the Buddha experienced some suffering. However, it is also true that the majority, the vast majority of the suffering we experience comes from what we do with our mind in relation to what arises in the world and how we react to the situation that we're in. And I was on a retreat recently with a senior order member called Vasantra, and he described Dukkha, I thought beautifully, as the friction between our actual experience and the one we'd prefer, or the one we think we should be having. So the friction between what we actually is at the experience and what we prefer or think we should be happening. And I think friction is such a great word. It's very, very evocative and certainly describes my experience of Dukkha, you know, that kind of straining against the way things are. And I was thinking about this in relation to my health, and I'm sorry to keep banging on about this example, but it's very alive for me. So because part of my health condition is I do experience some pain, some physical pain and discomfort. And I have found, actually, that if I don't push against that pain and I just accept, well, this is my lot, this is just the situation, and this is my body, and that's what's going on with it, and I'm at peace with that, well, I can be extremely happy. And as happy, I was reflecting, I'm as happy as when I'm not in pain. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? So my physical state really doesn't have anything to do with the amount of happiness I can experience. But usually I don't manage to do that, or often I might not manage to do that fully. And I strain against the condition that I'm in. So I think of all the things I'd rather be doing than lying in bed. Or I think I kind of resent not being able to do, having to cancel dates with people I want to catch up with. So I'm resisting reality. And I would say that this mental friction is responsible for over 95% of the suffering I experience from my illness. And that suffering can be terrible, far, far, far worse than the actual pain in the body. And this relates back to something Padaya was talking about last week, the image of the two arrows, the second arrow. So the first arrow being the basic fact of pain in the body, the second arrow being all the mental anguish that we heap on through our resisting, our response to that. And my experience is that the second arrow is usually much more painful than the first one. So in this way, my illness has become a very salutary teacher that it really is true that happiness comes from the mind. If I am, if my mind is samsarizing, there is misery everywhere. It doesn't matter what's going on around me. How lovely the situation. If my mind is in that wheel, I will be miserable. So to come back to the motivation, so why is it helpful to reflect on this? And I think mainly because it reminds us of the responsibility, it helps us to take responsibility for our fate. It's not, we're not just kind of at the mercy of this place that we live in, which is so awful, called samsara. And when it's nicer, we won't suffer. That's just not how it is, actually. We suffer because of what we do with our minds, and we can do something about it. We can't be passive in relation to our suffering. It's not going to magically go away. It won't pass when the conditions pass, necessarily. So we need to take it in hand and nirvanize, begin to nirvanize instead of samsarize. So to develop what Sangharakshita would call a creative mind rather than a reactive mind. Creative mind being creating, using the gap to create ourselves into becoming person that we want to become in the future. And this, of course, leads very neatly on to the law of karma, which is the fourth reminder. And as you can see, they do go very, very closely together, these two as a pair. Because, of course, it's the law of karma which allows this transformation to take place. So karma, the law of karma, of course, is that natural law of the universe which dictates that whatever actions we consciously choose of body, speech, and mind, very importantly, and that will start to shape and mould us into the person that we're going to become in the future. So it's karma that makes this move possible to begin to nirvanize, to have a creative mind. Helps us. It makes it possible for us to move from the suffering of the reactive mind into the relative peace and freedom of the creative mind. So that's really empowering, isn't it? So we're not at the mercy of how things are. We can change things, and that's what karma tells us we can do. It's very empowering. I think also a little sobering, because when we recognize the truth of karma, there's a responsibility, because we can't blame our suffering on anything else. And one of my another favorite quote from the Dhammapada, which is one of my favorite texts, is about karma. And it goes, not in the sky, nor in the midst of the sea,
nor yet in the clefts of the mountains. Nowhere in the world, in fact, is there any place to be found where, having entered, one can abide free from the consequences of one's evil deeds. So there is nowhere in the world that karma doesn't apply. Everything that we do has an effect, not just our evil deeds, not just unskillful things that we do, but skillful things we do as well, so that's the good news. But basically everything we do is having this effect all of the time. There are no neutral actions. We're either moving up or we're moving down. We're either, the actions we choose are either taking us out of the wheel into something more creative and happy, or down, deepening the ruts that we've got. And apparently there's no standing still in the spiritual life. So if you stand still, you're actually going down. So it's quite sobering, actually. And that's the choice that we've got. And I think it's also interesting to reflect on whether we believe in karma, because we're probably like, yeah, karma. We've heard that on like week two of the intro course. We agree with karma, otherwise we wouldn't still be here. But I think it's interesting to reflect on how much we really do believe in karma and the ethical precepts as ways to help us navigate the laws of karma. And I say this because, well, I believe in karma, but I don't always find myself acting in line with karma. And I suspect I'm not the only one. So I know that, you know, being loving and connected will make me happy, and yet I choose to be defensive and withdraw from people and indulge anger. And I know that selfishness is self-defeating and leads to misery, and yet I behave selfishly and I act as if having lots of things is going to be the way to become happy. So I don't think I'm alone in that. So it's just really interesting to think, like, we do believe it intellectually, but like, to what extent has that really permeated our being, and is it really, really influencing how we're behaving? And I think that's one of the reasons why it's such an important reminder, actually, because it shows up where we think our choices don't matter, where we think we can get away with it, maybe when nobody's looking, when there are no Buddhists around to check whether we're being skillful or not. Because sadly, we'll still be having effect even if nobody can see. And even if it's just in our mind, an energy that we're putting in behind our thoughts. Even when nobody's looking, our actions are still having a consequence. So I think it's quite interesting to take these second two as a pair quite explicitly as well. I was reflecting, well, if I suffer, it comes from my reactive mind, from my samsarizing. And because of the law of karma, I have the power to do something about that in every moment. Actually, that is what that's what we all have, a choice to transform ourselves in every moment. So those are the four reminders. So to sum up, the mind training is challenging us to change. And to do this, we need to be motivated. And so our preliminary practice, the first thing we need to do is to engage our motivation. That's our first job on the path. And so the four reminders give us a way to do this. So our human life, the precious human life, with all its freedoms and endowments, is a precious opportunity to practice. A precious opportunity. And it won't last long. We're not here for very long. And we don't know how long. So we need to make the most of that time, the time that we have. And to remember that as we're going along in that life, the suffering we experience is a result of what we're doing with our mind. And if we have a reactive mind, we will suffer. But because of the law of karma, we can really do something about that, and we can make a choice to behave in a different way so we don't suffer in every moment that we have. So you might want to think about which of those reminders motivates you. We're all very different, and probably different ones of those are calling to different ones, different of us, depending on our personalities and our life experiences and so on. So I just want to end on to say something about the spirit in which we should take these reminders and the mind training in general. Because I don't mind telling you that I don't find the mind training tradition very easy. I find it quite intense, and I sort of want to back off it. Find it very, very challenging and demanding. You might be all like, oh, well, this is fine, but I've traditionally found it quite challenging. and hard to engage with because of that. So I was thinking about a way, if you're having that kind of response, or just in case you do, I was thinking for myself of a useful way of thinking about the mind training. And I, whether to say this or not, it's a bit random, but I'm going to say it anyway. I like to think a little bit of the mind training is a bit like a chocolate truffle. like one of these. Like a Buddha Buddha, or like a vegan truffle, obviously, with a hard coating with like cocoa on it or something. So it's quite bitter and on the outside, quite difficult to get through. So when you first put it in your mouth, it might be a little bit bitter. But then, you know, inside you bite into the truffle, and then inside the truffle is all this beautiful, sweet, lovely goodness inside the truffle. So, stay with me here. So, I think it's not a perfect analogy, but the mind training isn't totally dissimilar from this, because you've got the kind of quite challenging, kind of intense dukkha and suffering and death on the outside, you know, that's what we're thinking about. But then, why are we doing that? Well, actually, that is a way of burning through our self-clinging and our wrong ways of seeing the world. So we get at something very, very soft and beautiful. It's all very much in pursuit of and in the context of love, of a pursuit of finding ways to go beyond ourselves and connect with people. And that's why we're doing it. So if that helps you at all to think of mind training like a truffle, go ahead and do that. I shall. But if you prefer a more traditional analogy, we could go back to the alchemy, which is what we started with. So, of course, we're burning away the impurities of self-clinging. We're burning away the impurities of our wrong views to get to that beautiful, soft sweetness of the awakening mind, the awakening heart, the bodhicitta, that ardent desire for our own liberation and the liberation of others. And that is why we are engaging in mind training. Thank you very much.